This is Critical Response, a disaster podcast exploring the past, present, and future of disaster management. From firsthand stories to expert insights, we dive into what happened, what we've learned, and what's next. Let's get into it.
Welcome to Critical Response, a disaster podcast. I'm your host, Alexander Patton. Today we're taking you inside one of the most significant disasters in Canadian history, the 2016 Fort McMurray wildfire. In May of that year, a massive fast-moving fire, later nicknamed the Beast, forced the evacuation of over 88,000 people, destroyed thousands of homes, and became the costliest natural disaster Canada had ever faced. But it also is a story of resilience, recovery, and rebuilding stronger than before. Joining me today is someone who knows that story firsthand, Jody Butts, Chief Administrative Officer for the Regional Municipality of Wood Buffalo. At the time of the wildfire, Jody was on the front lines helping lead emergency operations. Since then, he's been at the center of Fort McMurray's efforts to transform how the community prepares for, responds to, and recovers from disasters. Jody, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Take us back to May 2016. You were on the front lines when the wildfire hit. What do you remember from those first moments when the Beast turned towards the city?
Well, it is every year around this time, specifically May 3rd. You do have to take a time to reflect. So we're 9 years past that, but my recollection, I wasn't necessarily right on the front line as what we would describe as putting water on fire. I was in the Regional Emergency Coordination Center coordinating all the operations and suppression efforts. So that was my role during that time. And I think myself, like many, many others, couldn't believe what was happening.
Yeah.
Couldn't quite get our thoughts, you know, what our eyes were telling us, and then believing that that was actually true, or are we in some sort of a movie or a nightmare? Mm-hmm. But very quickly, it did become very clear that this is going to happen, and our community started evacuating, and we were mobilizing our suppression resources to kind of fight back that wildfire. It's I know everybody had kind of claimed it as the Beast, and it was big and big and ugly, but what we refer to it as the Horse River wildfire of 2016.
Gotcha. What's the biggest challenges you and the team faced during the evacuation?
Honestly, the evacuation in this region, in Fort McMurray, there's one way. Well, I guess there's two ways. You go north or you go south, but there's not an arterial of roadways for egress. So that was definitely a challenge. We were fortunate that we had a double lane highway going north and south. So, we just a sheer volume, we turned the northbound lane that was coming into the community to a southbound lane. So we essentially had four lanes headed south out of the community for a period of time. I got to say, in reflection, you just hope that everything works out. The hope that the plans are working as they were supposed to, and definitely, you hope nobody gets hurt. So I to this day still think that we're fortunate that we did have two young folks who were involved in a traffic accident about 2 hours south of Fort McMurray, which is incredibly tragic, but we didn't have, other than that, we certainly didn't have what could potentially have been a very traffic jam, log jam, kind of people stuck. It didn't happen.
Which is really kind of surprising, because like you look back at the videos and everything of that, and you just see these walls of flames coming right to the highway. And I'm still shocked to this day that more people weren't injured and everything because of that.
Yeah, Alex, I'll say this, and something that I've become very aware of, that these large events, these high impact events, what they do to the psychology of us as, I guess, people, as humans, if I could say, because we are a part of this big world.
Yep.
It's amazing how simple life gets when and how united everybody gets when there's a common foe. So you have the Beast that's coming at you, at your community. you're trying to run for your safety, you're concerned for your family, your kids, and you know all those things. But when I'm you know, that's where my mind goes, is that everybody understood everybody's situation, and mm-hmm. that we all had to work together to evacuate effectively, and that's what happened. And so again, my you know, credit to our community for doing that. It's pretty amazing, like you said, 88,000 people, and
definitely,
yeah, it was in a matter of, let's call it, hours. Mm-hmm. That's pretty. It was really stressful.
Definitely, yeah.
In the moment and at the time, but in reflection, pretty amazing at the same time.
Well, you hear about other disasters too, and like the panic that happens with them, and like how that leads to other problems at the same time. And like, of course, people were panicking a bit with the Fort McMurray wildfire, but it wasn't as. It seems like everyone had a mission to complete, and they fulfilled it. Like it wasn't chaos as it was, as some other disasters happen.
Yeah. And as I said, like, it's amazing what the human psychology does when mm-hmm. we have a common foe. Everybody instantly gets on the same page.
Yep.
You know, if you could run a hockey team and everybody's pulling on the, you know, get on the same page and work together like that, man, you would win lots of championships. And our community certainly did that day.
Awesome. Was there a particular turning point or decision that stands out for you during that wildfire?
Oh, yeah, we've had lots of time to reflect. yeah, decision points. You know, there were obviously the one that this is real and we need to evacuate. Mm-hmm. I would say that was probably unprecedented. My recollection goes back to, I think it was 2011 when we heard about Slave Lake wildfire. Yep. And then so, but now it's us, and so that was a critical decision point there. You know, and then there was many decision points through the following next 2 to 3 days from a suppression mm-hmm. operational standpoint. We had to sacrifice some infrastructure, some yep. houses to stop the spread of this fire. Like it was, you were just chasing it. So we had to get in front, create a separation, and then stand our ground. And that, yeah, there's quite a few stories and that are still amongst those of us that had stayed behind. So mm-hmm. yeah, there's, you know, there's lots of things there. It's something I've told anyone who wants to listen that it's, for everyone that's still here or that had experienced that, and to our, you know, the residents that evacuated, and to our first line responders, to, you know, the RCMP, to the yeah. to the volunteers, we all have a common bond, and that'll never be lost.
Definitely.
And so
definitely.
We all have our own story to it, which was very, very unique and interesting. As you know, the community was evacuated for 28, 30 days, a month, yeah. let's call it a month. And, you know, the reentry point was that was another big decision on how to reenter safely. Mm-hmm. But just a little bit of the thought process, we were, you know, we had stayed behind and we had fought fire, and then we had to, you know, create a safe space with the hot spots around the community mm-hmm. and inside the community and all that stuff. We had, you know, we worked long hours to get the community back to a place where it's safe to re-enter. And we were, it was mixed emotions here. We were hesitant to see, you know, how the community would receive coming back. Mm-hmm. 'Cause in our mind, we, you know, we lost, you know, upwards 23, a little over, I don't know what it was, a little over 2,000 structures. Mm-hmm. But I remind everybody, you know, you'll always be able to measure what was lost, but you'll yeah. never measure what was saved. So I frame it from a standpoint that we've saved 92% of our, mm-hmm. of the city. So, it's a little different, but it sounds better.
Definitely.
It was a lot of work.
Well, and at the same time as this is all going on, this is your own community, and like this is where you and your family and everyone lives, and same with the everyone involved. So at the same time as you're thinking of everyone else, you've got to be thinking about your own life and how it's being affected.
Yeah, that's that human the human in all of us. Mm-hmm. First of all, you think about your own family, make sure they're safe. Mm-hmm. We've had some of our firefighters that actually that lost homes. I think there was somewhere up around 18 of them, and yet they couldn't go save their own homes. They had to stay mm-hmm. on point, on mission, and save the greater good. So a lot of those stories happen. Yeah, definitely. A lot of them.
In the aftermath, there were reviews and reports on how things could improve. From your perspective, what were the most important lessons learned from a disaster?
Well, I guess having gone through it and having also, let's talk about the recovery phase. Mm-hmm. And I use the term resiliency. And I've went through, a bit of a process of my own internalizing what resiliency means. And we hear that in sport. We hear it quite often. And sometimes it's probably overused. But I've reconciled to what resiliency means to me. And that's something that any person, any family, any community, any organization, any business can absorb the impact of a disaster or a change, and then how they adapt to it, and then finally what do you do to recover, and how are you going to take that next step? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of drove my philosophy in behind how do we come out of this stronger?
Yeah.
And so we certainly fortunate to have the amount of support that we had across the country, mm-hmm. right? From government to Red Cross to the donation and the volunteers, that definitely helped. But the biggest thing is making that commitment to learn from your lessons.
Yeah.
Learn from those experiences. I say this in the best of ways, don't let a disaster go to waste.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what? It was hard during that time. Wouldn't it be wasteful if we didn't learn from it and be better and so when the next time happens? And you know, Alex, that's the other point I just want to make here is in that moment, I think it can't happen to us.
Yeah.
That's not what we think anymore. We think that it's when.
Exactly.
And so we, Fort McMurray and all of the region in Wood Buffalo here lives within the boreal forest, and we got caught in a moment of time. So the boreal forest requires fire for its survival, and it will regenerate, and it will burn again. Hopefully it's not going to burn when I'm still around here, but my point is we're 9 years and we're starting to see the old burn areas in 216 sustained fire again.
Yep.
So the boreal forest will regenerate. It's Mother Nature. It's the beautiful thing about it, but you need to learn how to live within it, or else it will teach you another lesson. And so very proud of what we've done in this region from our fire smart to our emergency mm-hmm. planning to, our emergency social services, all the things that we've been working very hard since that time.
Okay. So if a similar wildfire threatened the city tomorrow, how would your response look different compared to back then?
Well, I'll say that our relationships with our, if we're talking about fires, that's mm-hmm. the Alberta Forestry is the leading agency in that world. Our relationships and communications are very, very strong, which leads to our level of situational awareness. We have taken upon ourselves to become very aware of the wildfire hazards that mm-hmm. exist from day to day. And that's, largely driven by Mother Nature, the time of year, rains or the hot, windy days. Our levels of situational awareness are very high, much higher than they were. And then you get into the operational things, our communications. We have a single communication system that we all work on. The Alberta, the AFRAX is what we call it in Alberta. So we're all there. And then from a planning perspective, here in the region, and it maybe doesn't work everywhere, but we made the conscious decision in 2018 to take our emergency response plan and flip it on its head and make it a community-based response plan. So you know, during the fire 16, we had one plan that was an all hazards that was meant to cover all areas of the region. That's not the case no more. Community based, meaning we have we've got the larger urban center here in Fort McMurray, but we also have the six rural communities that are within the region, and not to forget that, you know, from a jurisdictional perspective, we've got the Indigenous, the First Nations and the Métis that populate those communities. And as you know, the First Nations have their own jurisdiction. So lots of those conversations continue. Our planning is far advanced from where it was. I could go on and on. I guess there's one kind of unique piece that we developed here since the fire was the Vulnerable Persons Registry that we're very proud of.
Okay.
And that's essentially, it's a free registry. You know, there's some qualifications, but that resiliency piece, those folks that when their daily routine is interrupted, that they can't adapt to it. So those are the folks that possibly have mobility issues, or there's some sight or hearing impairments, or, you know, even our elderly that are living at home that can't get around. Those types of things, there's a qualification. But the intent of it was that we would, this registry that is developed in emergency, you know, with emergency services, would make us aware of the vulnerable, someone that is vulnerable, and let's say the vulnerable population within that potentially impacted area, that disaster. And we would go in there 48 hours ahead of any possible evacuation.
Okay.
So that it's controlled, and it's, maybe they need an ambulance, so we need to, you know, all that sort of thing. It's calm, it's controlled, and getting them out of harm's way. And it's been very successful. We've used it probably since it's been, I'm going to say 3 to 4 times.
Okay.
It's worked out really well. Really, really proud of it.
Awesome. Speaking back on those community connections and with external organizations and authorities, what does that look like, those partnerships with like other municipal governments, First Nations, industry, your citizens, everyone? How did that take effect since the disaster?
Well, I think it gives everybody motivation to, and everybody with a common interest, that we need to work together here.
Mm-hmm.
And not saying we weren't doing it before, but
definitely.
Now it's certainly with a purpose. And we've carved out a piece of that to suggest, you know, we talk about lots of things in partnerships, but we carve out a special space for emergency management.
Okay.
And there's a spot there for, you know, leadership and industry to talk to, that government to government kind of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that intently, not to put it on an agenda that gives it 20 minutes and then we move on. No. We need to understand from our leaders, from our communities, what keeps them up at night. I use that question lots. What's keeping you up at night? And so, and then just let it go. Like, let's hear it.
Yeah.
And it's really informed the emergency planning moving forward. And again, remember I said it's back to that community base. So get the leaderships in those communities to get together, leader to leader conversations. And as an emergency management program, we sit and listen. And we learn, and that's what kind of drives that funding, or sorry, that planning.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a recent example, and I'll say up here in the northeastern part of Alberta, we don't have many neighbors per se as municipal neighbors. I know there's borders and boundaries, but we've got Northwest Territories to the north, Saskatchewan to the east, and then it's largely just Boreal on our
western
border. So there's, you know, there's not much interaction there. However, I mean, we have roads that run through, but however, we have more in, you know, our more of our conversation is with our local First Nations, as we know, is they have their governments. Industry is a big part. Forestry is certainly front of the conversation when it comes to wildfire, but we've established this year going into this wildfire season, the first memorandum of understanding with the First Nations government on strictly emergency management. Strictly okay. emergency management. And what that means is if an event happens from a pre-planning perspective, here's how we can, here's you, how do you, how can we help you? Mm-hmm. And then that's all predetermined.
Awesome.
And then in the moment, it's not, you're not trying to, you know, it's all kind of, you're not trying to think and figure it out.
Definitely.
Because it's, you know, it's stressful.
Yeah.
And emotions run high. And in some cases, then there goes the relationship that you thought you had. And you thought you had a common understanding. But, yeah, so that's kind of the future for us here, Alex, is, you know, having them pre-plans with our First Nations folks and making sure industry is a part of that planning phase and that we're at that government-to-government relationship.
Awesome. So prevention is a big part of the story now with wildfires. What is the municipality doing to prevent or mitigate the wildfires in the area?
90% of what we're doing is prevention.
Okay.
And I say that from an investment perspective. We are putting our efforts towards prevention. We double down all chips all in on the Fire Smart program to the point we are very proud of our Fire Smart program here. We've got our own trademark, Fire Smart Wood Buffalo.
Okay.
And that's there's the only one in Canada like that, but
nice.
We've accomplished Fire Smart communities within our region now, but that never goes away.
Yeah.
We've got to weave that into our communities. And mm-hmm. so I would say that if you were to walk down the street and yelled out at the top of your lungs, Fire Smart, and ask somebody, have you ever heard that? Do you know what that means? I'm pretty confident that anyone that lives in this community and been around here a couple of years, it's not the first time they've heard it.
That's good.
and so that's been a goal of ours to make sure that just making sure there's that education piece that our communities can do. Like we've certainly surrounded our communities and thinned out the vegetation.
Okay.
But what happens with that ember transfer that mm-hmm. falls into the community, right? So that's where that's where we're doing the Fire Smart home assessments. We've got some insurance, not the whole insurance industry, but some of the insurance companies right alongside of us. They recognize the risk, and so if you have a good score on your home fire assessment, or you want to change out some building material to be more fire resistant, you're going to get a tax break.
Nice,
with certain tax breaks, and we've actually the municipality along with some of the insurance companies have a little bit of a rebate. So
cool.
If you do want to change out your shingles or you want to change out from a wood deck to a composite deck, there's some grant funding there to offset the increased costs, if there
Perfect.
Is some. So, yeah, lots of those little things. There's lots of them things that are going on.
And are you finding the residents and are generally supportive of all this and doing their part, like clearing brush and all
that? You bet. And so there you go. Don't let a disaster go to waste.
Mm-hmm.
I would say before the wildfire, it was very difficult to convince communities to let us in there to peel this back. And they even when we returned from it, we re-entered the community, some of the homes we had, you know, there's trees up to their back fence.
Yeah.
And that's something they valued. Well, we pushed them. We pushed that. We pushed those trees back to create some space for two reasons: to reduce or prevent the radiant heat transfer from a forest fire onto the house,
mm-hmm.
and then also a defensible space for our suppression resources, our first responders. So there was, you know, initially there was some. It was black, and a dozer had went through it. It didn't look nice at all. But we cleaned it up. We put some grass to it. We put a trail there. We put a Fire Smart tree there, and we used that space differently.
Yeah, definitely.
Than before, and so it has a significant public safety impact that space. And hey, you're using some space. So, yeah, I would we continue to go in the trees and thin the trees out and do the fire smart work without without any objection, I'll be honest.
Perfect.
Before we'd have to do extensive community engagement and da-da-da-da-da. Now it's, yeah, there's the fire smart sign and they're out doing it.
Awesome.
What we also do though is, you know, when you're cleaning up the forest floor, some of the dead and down trees there,
yep.
We, you know, we ask our staff, our contractors, however we're doing it, to, you know, cut the logs up and pile it up and leave it for the public,
yeah,
to come and get and use as firewood.
Nice.
And they're fire permitted safe pits, right? But
yep, exactly.
Yeah, that's the interaction with our community. And
perfect.
You know, I'm very proud of them. I'm very proud. Everybody knows the term fire smart.
Awesome. And so Fort McMurray is very big with the oil industry and everything. What role does oil companies and their resources play in your emergency plans and recovery and everything?
Yeah, you know, the oil sands industry in this region is large and vast.
Mm-hmm.
We've got very big companies with big sites, operating sites, that we've got smaller companies that don't,
yep,
take up so much room. So it varies, but I'll say that the industry is obviously very supportive.
Perfect.
This region up here provides... Oh, you're going to have to spot check me on this, but, you know, 25% of the national gross domestic product kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I know when we evacuated, we shut down production, and that really, mm-hmm, it impacted the national, the, you know, the whole nation. So, mm-hmm, that's not lost on anyone. Even us as resources, and I know with forestry, that's a big significant decision, mm-hmm, factor when you're prioritizing resources, as you know, loss of production in our oil sands of the, yeah. So,
well, I know this
for a fact, of the 5 million barrels that we export every day, 4 million of them come from this region.
Yeah, definitely. And I remember during the 2016 wildfire too, like, some of the oil camps were actually used as an evacuation point and everything at first.
So good point. We're very fortunate to have the resources that we have. So, yeah, you know, the folks that went north, we utilized some of those large, large camps, 3,000 person camps,
mm-hmm,
to house evacuees. And they were very receptive and supportive. And, you know, they've got, industry has some aerodromes to the north. So they were flying folks out of there that went north. And then, you know, some of the larger oil sand sites have full-time emergency service departments, and they certainly were the first ones here when we called their help.
Okay.
And they, you know, we're really fortunate. Really fortunate to have what we have in the region.
So transitioning a little bit to the recovery, it's been nearly 9 years now since the wildfire. How is Fort McMurray doing today in terms of recovery and rebuilding?
I think we're in very good shape. Honestly, when you look at the length of time, you know, that's up. You know, we could sit here and debate that all day. We look at population, we look at new builds and all that sort of thing. But the areas that were affected, like that were burnt and were affected the most, in a large part, they're fully rebuilt. And they were fully rebuilt last, like, 3-4
okay,
years ago. There's still lots there that haven't rebuilt, but for whatever reasons,
yeah,
insurance or the owners, you know, whatever, there's still some of those, they're spotty,
yep,
throughout those areas, but yeah. And so, you know, and then COVID,
yeah,
hits, right? Remember that. And so, I would say there's a lot of things that have impacted this region. We had a flood,
yes,
in 2020,
yep,
recall that. COVID hits at that same time, 2020. So yeah, there's been a lot that's going on. Our community is strong. I think that we are, when I look out there, the traffic is busy. I think our,
yep,
schools are careful what I say, but they're oversubscribed.
Yep.
there's lots of kids in the classrooms. I just heard the other day that our minor baseball was, overwhelmed with the amount of kids that are,
nice,
signed up to play baseball Our ice surfaces, you know, we're short of some ice surfaces due to the amount of kids wanting to play hockey. And so those are all signs that are we've got a pretty vibrant and active community that's thriving. We're good. I think we're in good shape.
And you've talked about a little bit about this before, but it's not just about the homes and everything. It's also about the economy too. What has the journey been like to get Fort McMurray's economy back on track after the fire and the challenges that followed?
Well, so largely our economy is linked to the industry. So very quickly did the oil sands get back up and going. Now let's remember that the wildfire affected Fort McMurray urban and well, Anzac a little bit and Sapre Creek, not to lose sight of that, but and it 92% of the houses were saved. Critical infrastructure wasn't damaged. We had to we didn't lose schools or hospitals or underground wastewater and potable water services. We had to clean out and do a little bit of remediation work during recovery for our water plant because that's a whole nother story. But we didn't lose any functionality. We just had to come get back into the health standards. So all those things didn't, you know, we were very fortunate to save a lot of that critical infrastructure. So it enabled us to stand back up pretty quickly. I would say then comes the, there's probably a lingering, even for the fact that you're calling on this, there's this lingering piece that kind of, you know, hangs over our community. And I would encourage anyone to look past that, that we're
more than just a wildfire.
You know, I've said this many, many times that, you know, that 2016 wildfire will forever be a part of our history, but let's not let it define us. And I'm going to say that we certainly don't sit here and mull over it. It's in our past and not to be ignored, like I said, learn from it, but it is in our past and we're looking forward. So we're in good shape. And honestly, the oil sands, they were up and running and haven't looked back. And there are other external factors that impact that oil sand production other than wildfire. Definitely. So,
How has the increasing risk of wildfires and other natural disasters, like you talked about the flood, in the age of climate change shaped your planning in the community?
Yeah. again, getting to that realization that something's different here. Instead of the wildfires are burning into the summer months when the forest is green, what's happening? Mm-hmm. That's different. And so we're having to extend our, you know, not letting our guard now, making sure that the lines of communication and the awareness is at a high level throughout the whole summer. Those are some of the things that change. But you know what though, Alex, those are things you can't control directly.
There's only so much you can do.
There's only so much you can do. What you can do is what you can control right in front of you. When we're talking about climate change, that's a global conversation, right? So, I'll put my personal opinion out there that something's happening. Something's different. Something's different. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not going to sit here and tell us why. But something's different.
Definitely.
From an emergency perspective, the fires are burning hotter and faster than they were 20 years ago. Absolutely.
Talking about 20 years ago in the future now, looking ahead 5 to 10 years, what does disaster management in Fort McMurray look like that might be different from today, do you think?
Well, I would hope that we have even better a collective understanding of the hazards that we face. And I say collective that the work towards awareness and from government to government to communities, so that we're all in. When we get into that moment, we can operationalize the existing plans and get everybody out safely. I think obviously technology certainly is going to advance in its ways, and I will say a little bit about the suppression efforts. I mean, there's things that are changing in that arena, as far as forestry used to never fight fire during the evening for safety reasons. Now they're starting to, which is very good. I mean, so they have overnight a helicopter bucketing water onto fires. They have some crews out there overnight, which before that was unheard of because of safety reasons. So they're getting their mind around that. I've in my career as firefighting, I've seen the structural protection, resources come into effect, the sprinklers that go on top of houses and communities and that sort of thing, the little ones. Well, I think now I see a further evolution into large water surrounding communities, but you need to have big water. You got to have all those proper equipment, like big, big pumps, 12-inch lines, and big cannons for water cannons. So that's what's evolving here at the moment. I know the private sector is taking, recognizing a profit, profit opportunity there, which is fine in the moment we need it, but we're certainly looking at that as far as diversifying our suppression resources.
Last question. If you could give one message to future emergency and disaster managers, what would that message or lesson be?
Yeah, change your philosophy or your attitude. It's not about if, it's when. And that will drive and motivate you to have those conversations, to have those the planning, and you know, you're going to have to convince your public, you're going to have to convince your public officials, your elected officials, on that. And it's not easy. Hopefully you can do that without a disaster to motivate. That would be the best case scenario. And I would say that if you need anyone out there that's is committed to it and passionate about it, give me a call. I would be happy to share our experience, if to nothing else, provide some of that motivation. You know, Alex, look at what you guys are doing down there. Who thought Redwater would be evacuated, right?
So I have a buddy who lives right on the edge of it, and he was evacuated right at the last minute kind of there, and he was sending me photos, and it's just amazing, this big flame coming towards you.
So never thought that would happen, but should, because you should. And so I guess preparedness, we can prepare at an individual level, at a household level, prepare as an organization, and as a, you know, you can prepare as a business and as a community. And then again, back to that definition of resiliency, it's about any person, family, community, organization, or business to absorb that impact, to adapt to it, and then how do you recover and take that step forward? If you don't, you will find yourself, you know, you'll find yourself, I call in the quicksand. The more you wiggle, the more you sink. You have to find, you have to take the next step. And so that would be, my best advice to that. And I know that's probably not, well, what does that mean? Well, we'd have to have a further conversation. But,
well, it's just interesting to see how this, this field is growing too now. Like, we now have programs for disaster management here in Alberta and in Canada, where not so long ago, we didn't have these programs. NATE, we have the Disaster and Emergency Manager Diploma Program and everything. So we're starting to see the need for it more in Canada. But it is still a new and growing field, I feel, too.
I agree. And probably the fastest growing field in emergency services that we see that. So, you know, Alex, I have a question for you. Where do you think it fits best? Does it fit best in like an emergency service organization, or does it fit best in a, say, like a municipal organization, non-emergency? What do you think?
I think it fits better in an emergency situation field more. Like with the history of organization or history of emergency management here in Canada, it's people like you, the firefighters and everything, that kind of were in charge of emergency management. I think still it needs to be, you know, at a municipality level and everything, but I really am a big proponent of it has to be a partnership. We have to work with the Red Cross. We have to work with, everybody has a say in this. And I think that the connections are getting there, the relationships and the working together are there, but there's still more work to do. So I'm interested to see where the future goes on creating those partnerships and everyone working together to, instead of everyone kind of doing their own thing, which we can sometimes see, like for instance, on the provincial level.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I'm really indifferent whether it sits on the fire chief's desk because, well, it's an emergency, yep. So that's you. So here, you take care of it. And versus, say, a non-emergency position. As long as it's not on the side of the desk, as long as it has its own breath, or I guess its own space to be discussed and not part of an agenda, part four on an agenda to say, here, we got 20 minutes to talk about emergency management. Either way, as long as it's the resources are committed to it, and you know what, in some cases, it's not for everyone. It really isn't.
So, like previously in your role, you served, or I know you're CAO now, but you were the fire chief and the head of emergency management. How do you feel about having those roles together?
So good question. Yeah, regional fire chief and director of emergency management. You can see the fit.
Definitely.
Where the natural fit to that. It certainly I guess I was supported from the perspective that I was able to resource it, both on the emergency management and so that was good. We've got a good strong team there. That would be very difficult if the emergency management program wouldn't be where it was unless we were to do that. So you only have so much to do in a day. I will say that anyone listening who is considering, the fire chief and the director of emergency management, they are two completely different things. And so you're probably 95% of your, well, I should say that, but you're a fire chief, which means you're a leader of an organization of firefighters and that sort of thing. But then when a disaster hits, you have to put your director of emergency management hat on, and you have to go coordinate with a larger group of non-firefighters. Yep. So what happens there, Alex, is you leave your firefighters behind. And in those moments, they need that leadership. It's a lesson that I will share with anyone listening out there in that similar situation. People need to be led, and you need to be there for them when those high stressful times. However, things are going right along on the emergency management side, but that's where there's conflict there. So
awesome.
Yeah, that's just my personal experience. Any outside of an emergency, though, you have to have good people that are. It is a different mindset when you are thinking about response versus planning, and so the fire departments are response, right? Largely, and emergency management is about planning and about preparedness and training and exercise and all that stuff.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Jody, thanks again for being here and for the important work you're doing in Fort McMurray.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
Once again, thank you to Jody for joining me today. And to my listeners, thank you for tuning in to Critical Response. If you found this episode valuable, I'd love for you to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with colleagues or anyone interested in how we respond to and recover from disasters. You can find show notes, guest links, and more at criticalresponsepod.com. Until next time, be safe.